Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, the rule of law, the end of law, lawyering, and Dimitri Lascaris. This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. The world as we know it is gone. So said British Prime Minister Keir Starmer a few days ago. Sound frightful? Take a close look. Sir Keir was contemplating the consequences of Donald Trump's on-again, off-again, on-again global tariff war, now wreaking havoc on financial markets, in stock exchanges, and in corporate boardrooms from Wall Street to Taipei. The financial world, in Keir Starmer's mind, the world of big business, powerful corporations, and several thousand fabulously rich men. Starmer, a lawyer, was not thinking about the unspeakable crimes his friends, Israel and the U.S., have been allowed, indeed enabled, to commit in Gaza for the last 18 months, turning the global community's most cherished statutes, the U.N. Charter, the 1948 Genocide Convention, the four Geneva Conventions of 1949, into a set of empty shells. Starmer was not thinking about the paralysis of the UN Security Council or the world's most powerful states in the face of these crimes. Germany, France, the European Union, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, China, Russia, the UK itself. The end of law in the world of war is not something Keir Starmer is likely to opine on in the editorial section of the Sunday Telegraph. For thoughts about Sir Keir, his fretful writings, and related legal matters, the GPM reached out to an old friend, Dimitri Lascaris. Lascaris is an activist, journalist, polemicist, and lawyer, now fully independent after quitting his law firm. We reached Dimitri Lascaris in Kalamata, Greece. Dimitri, you've just resigned your law firm, the law firm with whom you've been working for some years. I'm going to save that for last. I'm going to ask you to talk about that, but let's save that for last. But I want to begin this conversation about the law and lawyers and lawyering with this comment from Sir Keir Starmer, who said the other day, quote, "The world as we knew it has gone. The world as we knew it has gone." So Sir Keir was and is talking about Trump's tariffs, Trump's imposition of global tariffs, totally upending the rules-based international order, bringing things back as far as U.S. trade policy, global policy reverberations is concerned, back to the 1930s of all times, of all the decades one could bring us all back to, the 1930s, when tariffs were wild and crazy. And so Sir Keir Starmer and others are saying this is truly calamitous to the rules-based order. And he says the world as we knew it has gone. Meanwhile, this entity that I call Israel USA is committing acts that are seemingly unimaginable and conjure up the worst crimes of the 1940s, which, you know, genocide and mass murder and the rest of it, which truly led to the post-war international legal order embodied in the United Nations Charter and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the Genocide Convention and the Fourth Geneva Convention and the International Covenants on Civil and Political Rights and so on, that Israel USA has shown that this body of international legal canon is just a bunch of empty shells, completely meaningless. And it astonishes me, this. I mean, these laws count for nothing. And yet nobody's talking about this, it seems to me, right? Like Keir Starmer is not bemoaning this when he talks about the world as we knew it has gone. And, you know, Macron isn't, and the guy in Germany isn't, and the European Union isn't, and the mass media isn't going on about what Israel and the United States' actions over the course of the past, 17 months mean for international law embodied in the UN Charter and the Fourth Geneva Convention and so on. Can you comment on this? This is huge disparity. It's really Kafkaesque. I'm not sure how to call it. It's trade law on the one hand, and that everybody's talking about, and on the other hand, the rules of war.
Let me start by pointing out that Keir Starmer is, like me, a lawyer with many, many years of experience. And given the position that he held within the British justice system, he should be intimately familiar with the requirements of international law. That's number one. Number two, what does Keir Starmer mean when he says we, the world as we knew it? In the global south, the world that Keir Starmer and other Western leaders now confront is the world that the global south has been dealing with for our entire lifetimes, David. They never respected international law in the global south. Didn't do a particularly good job of respecting it even in the West, these Western governments, and the United States in particular. And, and let's focus in particular on tariffs, okay? Tariffs could simply be characterized as another form of economic sanction, right? The thinking behind the imposition of tariffs may be slightly different from the thinking behind what we traditionally think of as sanctions, but they're just another form of economic sanction, and the Global South has been dealing with economic sanctions forever. We remember, you and I and others who care about human rights, when Madeleine Albright, she was asked about the hundreds of thousands of Iraqi children who were killed directly or indirectly by U.S. sanctions. And she said, this is a price we are prepared to pay. Well, it was the children of Iraq who paid the price, not Madeleine Albright or Americans. So this is not new to the global south. It's not new to the non-Western world. It's only new to Keir Starmer and Western governments. So now they're getting a taste of their own medicine from Trump, what they've been doing to other countries which have been in a far weaker position economically than Britain is today, despite all of its, economic challenges. And what I find really most outrageous about Keir Starmer's comments, talking about the rules-based international order and the world as we knew it, is that he has been aiding and abetting Israel's genocide in every conceivable way, David, from the very beginning. They're providing weapons to Israel, huge amounts of weapons. I went and I reported from the British base in the southern Cypriot peninsula of Akrotiri several times. And every time I went there, I saw massive military cargo planes taking off in the direction of Israel. 2 days ago, Matt Kinnaird pointed out, an anti-imperialist journalist in the UK, that as Israel was launching a massive bombardment on Gaza, which killed, and wounded hundreds of Palestinian civilians, the British sent a spy plane from Akrotiri over Gaza, and it hovered over Gaza for 5 hours while this massacre was happening. Are we to believe that it wasn't providing intelligence to Israel as this went on? Of course it did. So the British government is up to its neck in the blood of Palestinian children. So for this clown, this charlatan, for whom I have the utmost contempt, to be talking about what we in the West now have to endure at the hands of Trump is just the height of hypocrisy and, disingenuousness. They are fully complicit in the crimes of the U.S. government and Israel in the British government. And that's also true, I'm sad to say, of pretty much every government in the West. Here in Greece, where I'm currently situated right now, I look out my window, I can see a military base, an air base of the Greek government, where there is a training center operated by the murderous Israeli drone manufacturer, Elbit Systems. And, over my house, every night for the last 2 weeks, I have heard warplanes of the kind that Israel has, because I'm familiar with the sound they make, because I was in South Lebanon repeatedly over the last 18 months and heard them.
These would be F-35s.
F-35s, F-16s, who knows what else. But these sounds are not the sounds of the training jets that we normally hear flying over the Bay of Kalamata during weekdays in daylight hours. This is a different type of jet that is not stationed here at this this airbase. And when I checked, because I it was obvious that something had changed, something was going on, I discovered that that the Greece, Spain, France, the United States, the Qataris, the United Arab Emirates, I believe it was the Slovakians, the Italians, and worst of all, I'll come back to this in a second, the Spaniards are participating in these military exercises with Israel over the past 2 weeks here in the Eastern Mediterranean. I point out the Spaniards because Pedro Sanchez has been, you know, posturing as, you know, one of the few EU governments that have tried to hold Israel to account. Although they've imposed no real sanctions on Israel, he has condemned Israel's crimes at several points under grassroots pressure during the past 18 months. And yet here he is sneaking into a military exercise with Israel in the Eastern Mediterranean as Israel's genocidal regime is slaughtering Palestinian civilians in Gaza.
And there are no doubt. I mean, I'm sure they're planning for various things, but the Americans, the Israelis are planning on assaulting Iran, and this is all part of it. But I mean, I'd like to get into this in detail. But setting all this aside for the moment, the point is, setting aside Keir Starmer and the British and the Spanish, is that in the world today, in the halls of power and amongst those who wield and exercise hegemony and their acolytes and followers and allies and the mass media, it's the real disaster in terms of the law is trade law and tariff law is disrupting free trade and the movement of goods that make around the world that make a few people incredibly wealthy, you know, while impoverishing most of the other people on the planet. But meanwhile, a totally other area of public international law, the laws of war that really directly involve, you know, the rights and the protected realm of human beings not to be mass murdered, that this is not the issue. Nobody's talking about this, right? Macron, we don't hear the EU government or anybody or the mass media saying, holy crow, look at the world today. The United Nations Charter is in the dustbin, the International Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Fourth Geneva Convention. These were created in the wake of the Nazi Holocaust. We're in trouble. But they don't think that that's what makes us in trouble, that all that is thrown out the door. It's the fact that tariffs.
Right. When the U.S. takes actions that, you know, violate some agreement like the world, you know, the rules of the World Trade Organization, they raise these howls of indignation because this is harmful to large European corporations or European capitalists, right? That is a bridge too far for them. But as you rightly point out, David, you know, slaughtering children, executing 15 civil defense workers and paramedics one by one, you know, causing children to undergo amputations without anesthetic, destroying mosques, hospitals, the water system in Gaza. This doesn't offend their sensibilities. In fact, they're happy to assist it. But God forbid that you should, you know, harm the interests of large European corporations or the wealthiest Europeans. This is what gets them worked up.
I mean, this brings me back, you know, 5 years ago in 2017 and 18, when we were battling the Canadian Food Inspection Agency over the labeling of wines coming from settlements. And, you know, we progressively won at the federal court and then at the Court of Appeal. And while this was going on, like in the midst of us winning at federal court, it was, I mean, you may disagree, but it was almost virtually completely ignored by the Canadian media, completely ignored. I mean, other than Canadian press, everybody picked up CP's great ongoing reporting, right? But it was totally out of the news. What was in the news was Elbowgate. The fact that Trudeau had elbowed this woman on the floor of the House of Commons, or the huge scandal over the Kielberger scandal, right? I mean, granting an award to the Kielberger, you know, Craig Kielberger for whatever that thing was all about, right? That was totally in the news. It was just wall-to-wall media, but the media could not have cared less that the federal government, the Trudeau government, had gone to the wall to protect apartheid Israel's right to market its illegal settlement products on Canadian store shelves, unbeknownst to Canadians, labeled product of Israel, and conferring, you know, tariff benefits on those guys, right? Countermanding Canadian federal law, actually countermanding federal Canadian law. That's not what bothered the media. It was Elbowgate.
I think it's important to point out that this is one of the great services that the Palestinian people have rendered to humanity, and particularly to those of us in the West, at immense cost to their own personal well-being. And that is that they have exposed to a degree that was not previously understood by many people the moral bankruptcy of the media, the corporate Western media, and the governments at whose behest they act and report. So many eyes have been opened during the past 18 months. And I believe that one of the lasting legacies of this, the most heroic act of resistance I think we've seen in our lifetime, certainly that I've seen, is that we have achieved a new level of consciousness in the world today. We have yet to translate this into action and into the kind of profound reforms that we need in the West, but they have raised the level of consciousness in the Western world about what our governments and our institutions, including the corporate media, actually represent.
Now, getting back to Keir Starmer, Dimitri, I'm not sure if you've read the news today. 10 Britons accused of committing war crimes while fighting for Israel and Gaza. A war crimes complaint against 10 Britons who served with the Israeli military in Gaza is to be submitted to the Met police by one of the UK's leading human rights lawyers. A 240-page dossier to Scotland Yard's War Crimes Unit alleging targeted killing of civilians and aid workers, sniper fire, indiscriminate attack on civilian areas, including hospitals, coordinated attacks on protected sites, including historic monuments and religious sites, forced transfer, displacement of civilians. So a 240-page dossier being presented to Scotland Yard today against 10 Britons, the 10 English citizens, dual British Israeli citizens, for war crimes committed in Gaza. This seems huge to me.
It is huge, but if the system in the United Kingdom deals with these types of, as I understand what's happened here, David, this is a private criminal complaint, which is to say that the complaint has been lodged by private citizens represented by a very accomplished barrister with human rights expertise. This is a complaint compiled meticulously by private citizens, and it now lies in the hands of the Crown, the prosecutors in the United Kingdom, to decide what to do with this. I just want to relate this back to something that recently happened here in Canada. Someone whom you and I know and have tremendous admiration for, Rabbi David Mivesser, and also another person of immense courage, Palestinian-Canadian artist Rehad Nazal, brought a private prosecution against organizations that were complicit in helping, funding, encouraging Canadians who were dual citizens of Israel to go and fight in Israel. And a justice of the peace found that their complaint had sufficient merit to proceed and issued an indictment. And then what happened was, because the Crown in our system has the right or the prerogative to take over a private prosecution and then complete its take it to completion, if necessary, the trial of the accused. Okay, so the government exercised its prerogative to take over the criminal complaint of Rabbi Mivesser and Rehab Nazal, and then immediately exercised its discretion to end the case and shut it down. Took it over, shut it down. So the complainants appealed to the Ontario Court of Appeal after a judge said that the Crown can do this, and the Ontario Court of Appeal affirmed. So even though in that case there was a well-grounded criminal complaint approved by a justice of the peace, it ultimately got shut down by the Crown. And I think, you know, there's a high risk that we're likely to see the same thing happen in the United Kingdom, in no matter how compelling this complaint. The last thing he wants is to have, it's really a conflict of interest. The last thing he wants is for the British courts to be adjudicating claims of human rights violations against dual British Israeli citizens. I don't think he will allow it to happen. And I'm deeply skeptical that the British courts will stop him from putting an end to this complaint.
Another article, another story that's recently emerged, and I'm looking at the Guardian article here, is shifting gears, totally different situation. But Donald Trump's attacks on law firms in the United States, and the title of this particular piece, Trump's attacks on law firms are an attack on law itself. And this is all about these the various cases that law firms, Wilmer Hale firm that hired Robert Mueller that was investigating Trump's alleged nefarious activities in Russia and Ukraine, Jenner Black that does pro bono representative work for transgender people and immigrants, Perkins Coie who has challenged voter identification, voter ID registration infringements before U.S. court, and four American law firms have apparently backed down to Trump's threats, committing to carry out pro bono work for in cases that are aligned with Donald Trump's particular positions. So this article, Trump's attacks on law firms are an attack on law itself. What's your perspective on Donald Trump's campaign against law firms, apparently in the United States? What the significance of this is for the rule of law?
Well, as a lawyer, I instinctively condemn any attempt by any government to deter or punish the independence of lawyers, especially those who seek to ensure compliance with the law by people in high office. At the same time, I have kind of mixed feelings about this, David, because the law firms, let me just issue a disclaimer at the outset. I don't know too much about this story. I have not been following this story carefully. Okay. But there are a number of law firms, big law firms, maybe Wilmer Hale, one you mentioned, is one of them, I'm not sure, that have basically been doing the bidding of the Democrats. And what the Democrats did during the 4 years that Trump was in office. Is Trump a criminal? Yes, of course he's a criminal. Is he a fraud? Of course he's a fraud. But he's much worse than that. He's a war criminal. You know, he committed acts of extraordinary disregard for international law during his first administration. Nobody went after him for that. They went after him for relatively inconsequential expenses or offenses like, misrepresenting a campaign expense that was really a payoff to a porn star. He wanted, her to withhold information about his dealings with her. And so, he or his campaign staff mischaracterized this expense as being a legitimate campaign expense. So they went after him for that. What they were basically doing, a lot of these law firms, was they themselves were engaged in lawfare against Trump on behalf of the Democrats because they didn't want Trump to run. That's what was going on. And so Trump is, in a sense, and again, I stress, I have nothing but contempt and loathing for this man. Believe me, I do not. I would have loved to have seen Jill Stein win the presidential election and Donald Trump be shown the door and his, political career brought to an end. But I don't agree with what a lot of lawyers did during the Biden administration, where they basically used the law in order to disqualify Trump from running against Biden. If they wanted to be serious about enforcing the law, they should have gone after Trump and Biden, both of them, for their most serious offenses, which are war crimes and crimes against humanity. And that, of course, is off the table. Would any of these lawyers, bring claims against the Biden administration or the Trump administration for these offenses, the most serious that a politician can commit? Somebody did do that in the United States in the last few months. It was this wonderful organization called the Center for Constitutional Rights. They brought a claim against the Biden administration for aiding and abetting a genocide and violating various provisions of domestic law. And although the federal court judge in California agreed that it was plausible that Israel was committing genocide, he said his hands were tied by something called the political question doctrine, and he dismissed the case. He said, According to U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence, we judges don't have the authority to weigh in on questions of this nature, foreign policy, national security, blah, blah, blah. It went up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and they affirmed his decision. And they even chastised him for recognizing that it was plausible that Israel was committing genocide. So the bottom line is, David, there's a lot of blame to go around here. There's a lot of, I have nothing but the highest regard for the lawyers, the attorneys at the Center for Constitutional Rights. But these big bad law firms out there like Wilmer Hale, I don't have a lot of sympathy for them.
Let me ask you, who are Darryl Cruz and Jonathan Lysis, and why have you challenged them to a debate?
So Darryl Cruz is the president of an organization called the Advocate Society. This is an organization in Canada that represents 6,000 judges, lawyers, and legal professionals. He's also a star litigator at the Bay Street law firm of McCarthy Tétrault. And I know Darryl personally because when I was in law school at the University of Toronto in the late 80s and the early 90s, Darryl Cruz was also studying there. And he and I, along with two other law students, both of whom, by the way, became Bay Street lawyers, made up. We earned a place on the University of Toronto's Philip C. Jessup International Law Moot team. Okay, so we were fortunate enough to win the Canadian National Championship. I think that was 1990. And as the representative of Canada, we went on to Washington and we represented Canada there. And out of 48 teams, we got to the final. We finished second. So I mention all of this because I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that Darryl Cruz has at least a basic understanding of international law. I know this because he and I mooted together in the international law moot when I was in second year. Jonathan Lysis, is another high-priced corporate attorney at a firm called Lax O'Sullivan Lysis Gottlieb, also on Bay Street. Both of these gentlemen earned the big bucks. Both of them have received huge accolades from their peers, and understandably so. And Lysis, who, by the way, was born and raised in apartheid South Africa and came to Canada when he was 12 years old with his family, he led the charge to pressure the Advocate Society, the organization that Darryl Cruz heads, to revoke a speaking invitation to a Syrian refugee turned entrepreneur in Canada whose name is Tariq Haddad. Why did they do this? According to Lysis, why did he do this? He did this, first of all, because Tariq Haddad apparently used the word genocide once on social media, one time, to describe what Israel's doing to Palestinians. And secondly, because, according to Lysis, Tariq Haddad never expressed sympathy for the anguish of Israel's Jewish population. And so the Advocate Society capitulated to the pressure. It wasn't just Lysis. A number of unnamed, according to the Globe and Mail, a number of unnamed big law firms threatened not to buy tables at this, annual gala to be held in June called the End of Term Dinner, where Tariq Haddad was invited to speak. So basically a bunch of very powerful, influential Zionist lawyers, most of whose identities we don't know, pressured the Advocate Society, led by Darryl Cruz, to revoke the speaking invitation. And after, investigating this and learning, amongst other things, that Jonathan Lysis had acted for the state of Israel very recently in an Ontario lawsuit, I issued a challenge to them to debate me on the question of whether Israel is committing genocide within the Genocide Convention of 1948. Now, I've posted that, as I'm sure you've seen, that video on my YouTube channel. Last time I checked, it was approaching 14,000 views. But I didn't want to take the chance that they wouldn't learn of it. So I emailed it to them on Saturday morning. I sent them an email.
And your post was entitled Zionist Lawyers Embarrass Canada's Legal Profession.
Yet again.
Yet again. Yeah. So you emailed this to them.
Yes, correct. I emailed it to them and I said, at the end of this report, I issue a challenge to you for a debate. I hope you will accept my invitation. So that was Saturday morning. It's now Monday morning in Canada, and I have not heard a peep from either of them.
What do you think?
I just want to add that I said at the very end of my debate challenge, if you guys don't want to debate me, find the most persuasive advocate for Israel in the entire legal profession in Canada, and I'll debate that person anywhere, anytime. So I don't know, David. I mean, if they don't accept this invitation or find somebody else who's willing to debate me, I think that speaks pretty powerfully about the weakness of Israel's case. You know, I mean, these guys can, if anybody knows how to defend a position, you know, how to advocate their cause, presumably it's Darryl Cruz and Jonathan Lane.